Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Telford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Telford.
Hello, Josh Brown. Let's run down September's video games. By the time people listen to this, but this is going out immediately. We're not waiting till the end of the month.
No.
My brain tries to comprehend the fact that we've done a podcast this morning.
Yes.
More podcasts later in the week. A podcast right now.
The issue is, it is the end of the month. This is going to go out on the September the 30th, and by the time Friday comes around,
yes,
it's going to be September... No, no, August 30th. By the time Friday comes around, it's going to be September 1st, Scott Telford.
How is it September in like a week?
I don't know. How is Starfield out next Friday, man? What's that about? I know I've just spoiled one of the games there. I don't know if you know about Starfield. That's coming out next week.
It's not even just that either. But yeah, point being that at the end of each month, we like to get together and run down the coming games for the following month, which is to say that September is just about as rammed as August has been. And we'll just run some stuff down. There's a lot to get to. The 6th of September, so next week or so, is Baldur's Gate 3 on PlayStation 5 and Starfield over on Xbox systems. Which one are you playing first?
Starfield, man.
Are you Starfielding?
Starfield every time. The thing about Starfield is that's my most anticipated game of the year. I could leave it there. But I am so excited about what they have shown, even though I have kept away from a lot of the trailers, especially most recently. Mm-hmm. But you know when you just get a buzz because other people are buzzed?
Like, yes.
I was already excited for Starfield. But seeing more people get converted over to its side after they have shown off more and peeled back those curtains, just getting that secondhand excitement has been enough for me to cement it. And I was reading this morning on Insider Gaming, they had a report up saying that it's the most stable Bethesda game yet.
I saw that, yeah.
Which makes me obviously very excited because the main issue with Bethesda games in the past were the bugs and the amount of glitches at launch, including Fallout 76, which was obviously killed by bugs and glitches at launch. So to have a stable Bethesda game, to have those anxieties alleviated, I'm pretty confident in the game design itself. I am, of course, still interested in how they're going to tackle the 1,000 planets gimmick. Will that be satisfying, or will it be too broad for its own good? I don't know, but I'm eager to find out.
Yeah, my thing with Starfield is that initially, and it's because of Bethesda's history, I just wasn't bothered. I was bothered because it's a new IP from Bethesda, but I didn't trust them. My last game that I liked from Bethesda was Skyrim. And that was 12 or 13, whatever it was, years ago. I don't know time anymore, but it was a while ago. And so it was one of those things where I wanted to see what they were going to do. And when the gameplay leaked the other week, which I know that guy's been arrested now, which is like quasi-hilarious.
Is that right? I have not seen the update on that.
He put out like a 45, he put out a video. I feel like we should know his name because we need to pay respects to the man. But he put a video, it was like a 45-minute video, just playing through it, just his camera looked like it was on his lap as he was playing, just with a TV in front of him. He was like, here's Starfield, I'm just playing it. Lol, I've got a hold of it somehow. Playing through this game. I obviously everybody went, that's kind of crazy. You probably shouldn't have that.
Yeah.
And then he proceeded to do a full faced camera reveal.
Unreal.
Where he just talked about how good it was. And like, he's like smoking like a blunt or whatever during the whole thing.
I missed all this.
Yeah. And I remember people saying on screen, his gamer tag was on there. So immediately anyone who needed to know who he was, all the Xbox could track him down on Xbox Live. They know his address. He was immediately arrested. So just that guy, you know, not all heroes wear capes.
Extremely chaotic energy to all of that. I remember seeing, you know, I didn't watch any of it myself, but every single day I was checking the Reddit gaming leaks and rumors thread. And it was just like, new Starfield details, new Starfield details, new Starfield details. He's been streaming again. He's doing it again.
Thing is, I will say, though, that that guy provided a very good service of just showing us what launch day code's going to look like. I mean, maybe there will be a day one patch or whatever, but it did take, and it's such an indictment on the way the gameplay has been rolled out for this, that it wasn't until I saw that dude's footage that I actually went, oh, okay, this actually looks great.
Right.
Because then it actually did convince me that it was bug-free or relatively bug-free, and I got to see the new third-person shooting mechanics, how far along the dialogue and the facial animations have come since those early years when we first saw it, when it just did look like another Bethesda game. Now it does look like a meaningful step up, like it can be an Xbox first party or whatever. So I'm just mentioning all that because that dude's footage was the thing that convinced me. It wasn't anything official.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything that they've put out. And I think that the overall approach to this is to hedge bets and wait until, you know, you can get it in front of everybody en masse and let that conversation drive sales or whatever, or drive Game Pass subscriptions, etc. But yeah, it's one of those things that's worth saying that it has come a long way. Like, unless everyone's lying and all the footage is faked, it should be the strongest Bethesda launch ever, maybe.
I'm fascinated by this game because ever since I've worked with you, I think you have, like you mentioned there, been of the opinion that Bethesda isn't what they used to be. They've been letting you down, like you mentioned.
Yeah. And I've always... This is the second one of them. They've been letting me down. I think
you're not... made a game, correct me if I'm wrong, that you've enjoyed in like 14 years.
No, I think they are traditional to a fault. I think they've got a whole garage band approach and I respect them for it, but they need to get with the times and actually polish things and not just give us a toolbox that's all and ask the fans to put it together for them.
I've been always of the opinion, and I've been in the trenches with Bethesda, you know, I loved them. I loved Fallout 3. I loved all the Elder Scrolls games that I've played. Mm-hmm, I've really, really enjoyed their games. And obviously when Fallout 76 came out, a lot of people were saying, this is the end of them. Like, they're going in the wrong direction. Fallout 4, to some people, was very mid. You know, they weren't doing it anymore. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, no, I need one more stinker before I can, you know, declare them
right,
dead. They haven't done bad by me so far. Fallout 76 was an experiment. It wasn't for me, but I still really enjoyed Fallout 4. So they've never really put a foot wrong in terms of their big single-player games. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, I'm really hoping that this does not let me down and not kind of tarnish the years I've spent defending their brand, even though I didn't have to because they're a multi-million dollar, if not billion dollar company. But what I'm intrigued by is the depth of role-playing possibilities in Starfield, because while I like Bethesda games, I've never gone to them for complex choices, if that makes sense.
You know,
they've had interesting choices in games, but I think, and I'm not the first person to say this, I think H. Bomber Guy did a really good kind of dissection on why the moral choices in Fallout 3 weren't all that necessarily.
Yeah,
you know, they were quite binary. They weren't all that interesting. Unlike something like Fallout New Vegas, which does have more interesting possibilities, you know, deals in more shades of grey. The point being is, with Starfield not having a voice protagonist and kind of going back to more options and how you can respond to conversations and whatnot, will we get those interesting choices that have kind of become normalized in an era of The Witcher 3s and whatnot, where it's not just, do you want to nuke this town or do you not want to nuke the town?
I feel like the nuke choice always stood out because of the sheer scale of it. So I wonder if they have do you nuke the planet in this one? Do you remove one of the planets entirely or something? Yeah, there's a specific strand of like Bethesda humor that has been lacking. Like, only they really do it, and it involves the choices they give you, the NPC quests or whatever. But like, yeah, man, they've been out of the limelight for so long. Like, even Fallout 4, as big as that release was, still, like, for me, it didn't feel anywhere near as big as Skyrim. Like, Skyrim felt like the whole world stopped for a bit. Like, it was like, it just felt like Skyrim was everywhere. And it's like, Fallout 4 was big for gamers, but Skyrim was like this huge entity that it was just like, everyone was talking about Skyrim. At the time, and I, Starfield kind of feels like that. Like nearly all of us in the office have talked about one of our non-gamer friends who's messaged asking about Starfield. Is this when I get an Xbox? Is this what I do? And I forget the name of the PR person on Xbox's side that referred to Starfield as the starting gun of their exclusives or the generation. And it's like, well, it's been a long time coming. Like you're 3 years in, so maybe this actually is the beginning of the wave of exclusives. And Phil Spencer's the guy out there saying that they want to do 4 exclusives a year now, which they used to have 2 a year, which they didn't even stick to. So I don't even know if they can stick to that at all.
I'm trying and failing to not get ahead of myself, but I really hope this is the start. I really hope it is good. I really hope it is like the proof in the pudding for the Xbox series of consoles and why you need to own one of those machines. And I really hope that the friend I've told to buy a Series X for it will not be disappointed by this and whatever else Microsoft has to offer. That said, Scott Tilford, I will say there is a drawback to Starfield releasing right now, and that's that it's going to stop me, one, from playing Baldur's Gate 3, but two, from playing No Man's Sky on the PSVR 2.
You were never going to play No Man's Sky.
And I'll tell you my relationship with this. Okay, No Man's Sky dropped on PSVR 2 as a launch game back in February or March or whenever the hell I bought that machine. And I thought, now is the perfect time to jump in. It wasn't, because all the reviews said this could be better. The graphical fidelity is not it. Wait for an update.
Just play it normally.
I waited for an update. The update arrived. It wasn't that good. It didn't implement, to my knowledge, foveated rendering, which would have dramatically increased like the fidelity on display. That update dropped last week. Well, it's no good to me now. I can't play it now. 2 weeks before Starfield, where I'm going to do very similar things.
Sack off Armored Core and get on No Man's Sky.
But no. Yeah. I can't. You know how you sort of ate too much Dead Space pie by going through Dead Space 2 and 3 before going into the remake? Yes. I'm scared I'll do that and I don't want
to
do it.
I tell you what, though, I've had about 400 hours of Final Fantasy pie and I'm about to jump into Sea of Stars, if not Final Fantasy X again. Sometimes the pie's just that good.
Sometimes the pie is that good. The From Software pie is that good.
It's a very tasty pie. Speaking of, I wanted to mention the Xbox Series of... Xbox Series of Systems, which is the Series S and the Series X, and the whole contractual thing that Xbox has people signing over where they can't release a game on the Series X if it's not on the Series S. That's why Baldur's Gate is an exclusive to PlayStation 5 for now. That clause seems to have been broken for Baldur's Gate. It doesn't mean that Baldur's Gate's going to be arriving on Series X, in line with the PlayStation 5 on September 6th, but apparently they've reached some agreement with Larian where they are going to have Baldur's Gate 3 on Series X sooner, and they're going to work on the Series S version later. Apparently the whole thing with that game not releasing is that it revolves around getting split-screen co-op working on the console versions, and it does work on PlayStation 5, which is why it's out on the 6th of September. I mentioned that, though, as a wider thing, because it potentially points to the separation of the Series S and the Series X. Like, I've talked about this so much, but I just want them to focus on the Series X. Like, if you can make a Series S version, cool. That's your PlayStation 4 version of that game. Just like target the high-end stuff, have fun, build the big things, and let us enjoy the new generation of consoles. And if you can make it work for the wider system, fine.
I think the way they've approached this is very telling, because the last time we reported on this, it was Phil Spencer saying, like, look, yeah, we want games to be running on the S as well as the X, but there are already differences. You know, there are already differences in frame rates and resolutions, and that now seems to be going down to features in particular. You know, we're going to get a Series S version of Baldur's Gate, but it's not going to have that co-op element, that split-screen co-op
element. It was, but they were delaying it until they got it right.
Ah, well, the last report I read was that it was going to release, but it was going to just not have that feature in Series S. I think that's what was
either way
correct. I don't know, maybe not. Maybe
I think
I'm
you're
wrong.
Probably. I think you're probably right. I think it's the either way, there's the idea of a Series X and S not being feature perfect is the overall thing that you're still getting it. You're still getting a version of it on Xbox.
Absolutely. And to be honest, I think this is the right move. I think this is the right precedent to set where, you know, you do get a version of the game, but you're not guaranteed to have that kind of feature parity, just is in the same way that you're not guaranteed to have feature parity if you play a PlayStation 4 version of a game compared to a PlayStation 5 version of a game, you know, in terms of the amount of game modes in a Call of Duty or whatever. I think that's a good way for them to get around it. It might annoy a lot of Series S owners. I can totally see that, especially if they were sold on a feature that's now not going to be there.
That's true.
But it's a good way, I think, to get at least a version of the game running on hardware that might be too underpowered to deliver that vision or whatever. Or they might not have the time to kind of sink into it, because as we established last week, like, developing for all those systems is really difficult, especially when you have to take into account all the power disparities.
Yeah, and like, it is actually, we said before, like, and it's true, like, it is insane that you just accidentally gave Sony the exclusives. Like, you know, you gave them an exclusive that is one of the best games of the year, currently the highest rated Metacritic game of the year. But yeah, Baldur's Gate 3 on the same day as Starfield, 6th of September. Baldur's Gate is what I'm going to play first. I don't know how much I'm going to stick with it in terms of wanting to then try a bit of Starfield. I wanted to kind of do the prologues of both and then see which hooks me more and then go with that. But I'm way more curious in Baldur's Gate's case how it runs on console. And I don't mean runs performance-wise. I mean literally the UI. How have they made this incredibly mouse and keyboard-looking UI work on a controller? Yeah. Does that feel weird? And how, because the amount of options you have, the amount of right-click and then do this type stuff, that I don't know if we're going to have a weird hovering mouse cursor UI.
Maybe.
I don't know how they're going to do it. And I don't think, as far as I know, they've not shown that much of the console version off. So I wonder if the console UI and the menus and stuff are a bit more custom towards console gamers, because I think that'll be the thing that gets in the way.
Definitely.
Like, obviously, this game is, like I said, incredibly well reviewed and everyone's looking forward to it and whatever. But if it's up against Starfield and something like Starfield is just geared more towards console usability, then I can see that being a reason that console owners en masse just go, like, it's not even remotely for us.
Right.
We
get that
it's a huge deal for the PC crowd, but it barely works for me. I'm not going to go through all these menus and everything else. So I'm just curious. Like, Football Manager was never a big thing on console.
No,
and it's just,
no.
You know,
The Sims wasn't either.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. And it's like some behemoth franchises or well-received things just don't have the audience on console. And I'm just, part of me thinks that might happen with Baldur's, depending on how much it's actually geared towards that stuff.
That's it. You know, sadly, as a console gamer who doesn't get to experience these things, just some interfaces just work better on PC. Like, RTS games are just so much better if you play them with a mouse and keyboard and stuff.
Totally.
And it's a shame, because I always get excited for these games, and when they, I'm not saying this won't be, but in the past I've been burnt where that control scheme hasn't been optimized for a console. You just feel generally that you're getting like a downgraded version of what PC players are loving and enjoying, and I hope this isn't the case. But like you said, we haven't seen too much footage, I don't think, so
I don't
far.
Think so. I think most of it that has been shown off is the PC version, obviously running with various controllers plugged in, so it still simulates the buttons you would get on an Xbox or something. But yeah, I'm just curious what that is. Baldur's Gate 3, obviously a huge deal this year, kind of didn't necessarily come out of nowhere, but the amount of success it's seen, I think, is very noticeable or notable. And then the fact that it's just right up against Starfield is kind of hilarious. And the next thing I got down is on the 7th of September is Final Fantasy VII Ever Crisis.
What is this?
This is... they don't even know. This is another thing where when Square Enix showed off Ever Crisis through the trailer, they literally said another chance for a remake. So what they are doing with this is remaking the original Final Fantasy VII on the PS1 in terms of the camera angles, the general sort of look of it, obviously upgrading the character models and everything, throwing in a whole bunch of gacha and loot systems so that you can pay to swap out characters in those various scenarios, and retelling the Final Fantasy VII story across Final Fantasy VII, the PS1, the original one, across Crisis Core and across, I think they're including Dirge of Cerberus stuff, which was Vincent's spin-off thing.
Yeah.
But all done through this new sort of camera angle, gacha mechanic thing, where they kind of take the gameplay from the Final Fantasy VII remake, where it plays more like an action game, but then it's like a turn-based version of that, and you can, like I said, you can pay through loads of stuff. All the characters have loads of different skins. It's just this weird thing where... The thing that they're trying to hang it on is that they're doing an actual canon extension of Sephiroth. They're doing a thing of what was he like when he was younger.
Okay.
Let's actually show you what young Sephiroth is like, which I personally don't want to see. Part of the best thing about that character is that he's mysterious. You don't want to know everything about him. When he's got short hair. He's got long hair. I don't want to have short hair. But yeah, it's one of those things where they have a new story chapter to try and legitimize the whole thing. The vast majority of it, though, just feels like Square Enix going, like, we can gacha the living F out of this thing because it's Final Fantasy VII fandom, and if we haven't milked you enough already, we're going to squeeze even harder.
That's it. It's crazy how many Final Fantasy VII specifically spin-offs there are, and how many just attempts to milk that sub-franchise at this point there is. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the remake, and I'm looking forward to Rebirth as well, but there are so many Final Fantasy VII games that I'm just like... they come and go, and I have no idea that they've released when I'm getting news that they've shut down.
Well, this thing as well. That's the thing. They had the Final Fantasy VII, the Battle Royale First Soldier, which was in canon, because everything's meant to be canon. In canon was the way that they were deciding which like soldiers could become part of Soldier, the old caps lock version of Soldier that's in Final Fantasy VII. But yeah, Ever Crisis is only on phones for now, or will be on phones on the 7th of September. But it's just weird. Square Enix have this whole thing where they sort of experiment with... it's like abusive approaches to game design. There was a legendarily terrible Final Fantasy called Brave Exvius, where you just would pay to like re-roll different slot machines to get different characters, to beat different bosses, but it was entirely money-based. It was just this horrible thing. How much can we leech your love of this IP to get through? And it got absolutely panned, and rightly so, etc. And it's just that weird thing where they put the Pixel remasters out on phones first. They put the remakes of Final Fantasy 4 and 5 on there first. And now they're doing Ever Crisis, which in theory, like I said, has the Sephiroth story pack to it. So that wider audience would probably want to see that somehow. But I think they can get away with all the wider loot box stuff in a mobile context, because that audience won't hate and complain and get loud about it as much.
It's kind of a smart and genius and evil move, because you release it on phones and then you establish it as a mobile game. Mm-hmm. And then when you do port it over to console with all of those bells and whistles, you say, well, what do you expect? It's a port of a mobile game,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah.
And if you did it on consoles first, people would kick off. But because you know you've established that precedent, it's like, oh, yeah, I suppose you're right. Yeah, fair
enough. The thing that's horrible as well is that when they first showed it off and they said, like, another chance for a remake, and they showed the original bombing run, like the camera angle, the isometric camera angle of Cloud and Barrett and whatever going through the nuclear reactor, like the iconic intro from the PS1, but with newer character models. And people like me went, oh, they're doing the thing that everyone actually really wanted in the first place, which is just a reskin of the original in terms of the mechanics and the turn-based stuff. And then they threw in, like, oh, actually, here's, like, Red 13 fighting alongside Cloud at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, he wasn't there. So, like, oh, but oh, you pay the money, you can put anyone in here. And they've got, like, Aerith has a whole bunch of extra costumes, and it's just horrible. But I'm going to have to know what it is, because it's I need to know what it is. I don't know how much they're charging for it. It's probably free to play, and you pay with the cosmetics and stuff.
Yeah, maybe.
But another bit of Final Fantasy VII thing is coming out again. So,
bit of its soul carved off just to be cashed in.
It's nuts as well, because like I said, I've played through so many Final Fantasies this year, and I've just done so much general Final Fantasy reading, whether that be like making of stuff, playing through them all, like looking at different the artists and different inspirations for the games, the turnaround, the development time, etc. Final Fantasy VII obviously was a huge deal. It blew up. It's the biggest one by far. But it's nuts seeing them just stretch this one out so much, like overall, when they don't do that with any of the other ones.
Yeah.
And the other ones like are as worthy in terms of being great games. But for whatever reason, VII is just the one that it is its own little cottage franchise within Square Enix. But yeah, flagging that, because that thing's out on September 7th, but only on phones. So
what you're telling me is you're going to sack off Baldur's Gate, you're going to sack off Starfield, you're going to play that the day after.
I'm going to... like a sick freak, I'm going to have to play Final Fantasy VII Ever Crisis on my phone on the way into work on the train, which means I'm not playing Sea of Stars.
Terrible that.
I I didn't know what stupid lore stuff they do with Sephiroth, because everything they've done, like, since they tried to add the stuff on, they made it worse. All the stuff with Zack and Crisis Core, it's all horrible. So we'll see. 12th of September is Mythforce. Very quickly mentioning that, because that's the game that a lot of people will know as the Saturday morning cartoon-looking game, which is a first-person action shooter. It looks like Immortals of Avium in terms of the action, I guess. But the art style is very much like old-school Saturday morning cartoons, old-school Transformers, old-school He-Man, whatever. And to mention, that's when that game is out. I think a lot of people thought it was 2024 when it first got announced, but it is this year. Next one down is the 14th of September for the Crew Motor Fest.
Yeah, I'm actually really interested in this.
I'm surprised you're interested in this.
I am too, Scott Ilford. The Crew has always been one of those franchises that I've watched from afar, like, wondering, is it good yet? Can I jump in? Is this a sequel? Is this my entry point?
Right.
And I never jumped into the Crew 1. I never jumped into the Crew 2, even though I was really intrigued by their open world American design.
I did a little bit of 2.
I always wondered, you know, kind of like how Fuel, I think it was, had that massive landscape.
Yes.
And yet, like, the actual design of it wasn't that good. It was more like the scale over the substance. I always worried about that with the Crew. Mm-hmm. But I'm really interested in Motorsport, because it kind of seems like it's going toe-to-toe with Forza Horizon. Like, it's not that all America map anymore. It's just, I think it's a map, an island in Hawaii. So okay. It's kind of...
I've stopped following it now.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's this map in Hawaii. So already I'm kind of in by the smaller, more focused scale. And the level of detail in terms of the graphical presentation, I also think is quite impressive. Like, it's not Forza Horizon 5, mm-hmm. because this is on previous generation consoles as well, I think. But it still looks pretty impressive, especially compared to the other crew games. And mm-hmm. I'm just, the more I see of it, the more I think I can go for this. And I was doing a quick peruse of the Wikipedia page earlier on, no shame, and I saw that apparently it's been compared to Test Drive. I don't know if you played any of those games.
Oh my god.
But I loved the original Test Drive back in the day, so it's kind of just, you know, when it's making all the right comparison points,
right.
I'm like, Forza Horizon, good. Test Drive, good. In a Hawaiian island, really good.
I say this every sort of few days. I want to return to the arcade racing model. And I know that that's not necessarily what this is, but I want to be able to sideswipe a dude and watch them fly over the side of a road. Until I can do that again, I'm not going to invest too much in a racing game, even though I do play the Forza Horizon games. But yeah, I kind of forgot that we were getting a new crew.
I played
Crew 2 for a little bit because it was on PlayStation Plus. It's just, for me, it wasn't arcadey enough. It wasn't like, and then it wasn't sim enough either. So it was kind of like in between the two.
That in between is exactly what I like. You know, I like Sims enough. You know, I quite like Gran Turismo. I will be trying Forza Motorsport at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. I think it's at the end of the year, maybe next year, I can't remember.
Yeah.
And arcade stuff kind of died with me with Burnout, you know.
Right.
I loved Burnout to my core, but other arcade races, never really got into.
Split Second?
Never got into.
Blur?
Never got into.
No!
Never did it, man. And I know people love those games. I like the ones that kind of try to balance both worlds and give you that kind of sense of speed, that kind of accessibility in terms of the control scheme, but aren't so punishing that it maybe sacrifices some of the power fantasy you get with a Forza or a Grid. I really love Race Driver Grid as well.
I tell you what you need to get is Need for Speed Unbound from last year.
Ruled. Always look at that. Always look at that. And I think maybe now. But this is what I always do with racing games. I think maybe now, you know.
That game brought back a lot of the stunt work that I like from my Burnouts, like or from just general arcade races where you're taking to the skies quite a lot and you can slam into dudes and the graphic style's awesome. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing as well about this crew game. Again, hype it up a game I'll probably won't buy, but we'll just observe from afar. I also like the gimmick that the Crew 2 introduced, where it's not just cars. You know what I mean? It's like planes and it's boats. And I love that. You know, I really do.
For me, when I saw that with the Crew 2, I was like, oh, it's the Ubisoft every game. It's like, what models have we got left over? We had a plane from over here. We've got this from over there. Just put it all together. We have no idea. We have no idea what we're doing anymore, but we can just call this the Crew 2.
I don't know if it's going to be inspired by it, if it's going to be similar to it at all, but what was the... I've forgotten it so much, and I really enjoy the concept. It's the Ubisoft game, but it's got like a bunch of different styles in it where you can like snowboard, you can like skateboard, you can like BMX, you can like paraglide.
Oh, Riders Republic?
Riders Republic. And right. I always thought that was like such a cool concept.
It's a cool idea.
Like,
yeah,
it's kind of like a similar every game gimmick, but I kind of like want that, but with vehicles.
Yeah, I could tell. I mean, it's all born out of Mario kind of doing that thing. And then I guess the Super Mario, Sonic and All-Stars Racing Transform did it as well. And then the Lego game lets you go into boats and drive and stuff as well. Yeah, there's a way that could work if they can nail the physics and it actually feels fun to race. Then that's cool. On the 19th of September is another double release. It's Lies of P and Mortal Kombat 1. You're way more into Lies of P than me. I'm completely done with Soulsy stuff for a while.
I was watching 6 minutes of gameplay that was released before doing this podcast, and this looks like Bloodborne.
It does.
It always looked like Bloodborne.
There's a demo.
But it plays like Bloodborne. And I like Bloodborne, and Sony's doing nothing with that franchise, so I will take something evoking that style.
What if they put the 60 FPS patch out on the day that Lies of P drops?
That would be outrageous. I need more than a 60 FPS patch at this point. I need that full remake / remaster that's... you know, constantly rumored every 3 months. But Lies of P, I always, I especially watching this gameplay, I thought it looks like a mix between Bloodborne and Bioshock Infinite, like the art style of Bioshock Infinite in that kind of... I don't even know how you would describe it. It's like a retro...
It's almost like a carnival look. Like Americana, like, sell you all your dreams, kid.
Absolutely. Yeah. That carnival is the perfect word for it. Like, a lot of the enemies they were fighting in this gameplay video were toys brought to life, but, like, the old-school toys, like old-school Jack-in-the-Box, old-school, like, wooden toys, like Pinocchio or whatever. And I thought that was, like, really interesting because it's a nice change of pace from the sort of Soulsborne... gothic, dour, kind of like fantasy setting. Mm. I really love the setting of Infinite. I have my problems with the game, but it's a really immersive environment to be in, and this kind of like looks like that. It just, like you said, it's more Souls, probably to a fault, but as someone who has been eating that Souls pie for the past year and is still...
Licking his lips
for more, the Lies of P and Lords of Fallen, you know, later on seem to be ticking those boxes.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
That was my thing with Lies of P, where they put the demo out for it, and I went from like a potential to a oh hell no, like oh no, there's no, I can't. This is just the same thing again. It's all the big enemy jumps you and it kills you really fast. You learn the patterns in the first 10 minutes. No. I'm done with it. I need a break from it. I think I hate it. I've done way too much of it.
Yeah,
and I've done too many of these games in a row for almost 10 years now, and I just need a break from it. Elden Ring was phenomenal because it broke from that, and I can't go back anymore.
Right,
and it's like, I mean, I'm even playing through Blasphemous 2 at the minute, which is a very, very gorgeous pixel platformer take on the Soulsian genre. Even that game's framings and storytelling devices, and oh, the clouds did birth the heart. Shut up. I don't care.
Right.
I'm done. Like, just, oh my God, get it away from me. So, yeah, that's my general thing with this, is that it needs to be really special to stand out. And for now, I am utterly avoiding Lies of P and Lords of the Fallen.
Right.
Because I need to feel the hunger for that genre again.
It's funny because... And I don't know, would you describe Lies of P as a AAA game, or
I guess I wouldn't if we're saying AAA is Naughty Dog and Starfield level, then no.
But I still think, that said, it seems to be a cut above a lot of the other Souls-like games we've had. You know, yeah. For as much as I really enjoyed Mortal Shell and Thymesia, like, they felt more indie. They felt smaller in scale, whereas Lies of P and definitely The Lords of the Fallen, like, feel like they have that kind of extra edge to
they
it,
do,
that
they
extra
definitely...
sense of production. And I just, I'm intrigued to see what they do with that kind of extra set of resources because I quite like those other games that I mentioned, but I also cut them a lot of slack because I realize where like the budget is needing to be stretched or something. So I probably won't cut these games the same amount of slack. So they need to be that little bit more polished. They need to be that tighter to impress me, I suppose.
Yeah, and I definitely had that mentality with the first two Surge games and the original Lord of the Fallen, whatever the hell they call the original one, where it is that thing of like, oh, like you're being quite ambitious, you're going for it. There's definitely a thing happening in gaming at the minute where the visual bar has been raised, like the likes of Forza Solace, or just various other games that are adopting Unreal 5 in general. They just look gorgeous, but mechanically or the guts of them are quite simplistic. Like, Fort Solace is incredibly simplistic in terms of what you're doing. And I kind of thought that about Liza P once I got hands-on with it, where I was like, oh, this is just another one of them. It just looks absolutely beautiful. Liza P seems very, like, confident in terms of what it is, and it will scratch the Bloodborne itch. That's clearly what they're going for. With a legally distinct thing in terms of all the clockwork mechanisms and all the Pinocchio stuff. Mortal Kombat 1, we did a podcast on that after the beta weekend, which I think was just last Monday, actually. So you can go check that out for more in-depth thoughts in terms of getting hands-on with the game. But MK1 is my remaining most anticipated game just because of how perfectly the beta played. It's the opposite of Liza P. Going hands-on with MK made me go, no, I need this.
Nice.
In a way that beforehand I was like, maybe it's just more Mortal Kombat. It is, but in the most like streamlined, beautiful, just incredible way possible.
I love that we've kind of got a few Bethesda-style branching paths out of this year now. Like, I'm going to go Starfield, you're going to go Baldur's, I'm going to go Liza P, you're going to go Mortal Kombat. You know, I quite like that we've got these little pivot points in the year. But yeah, I can only echo what you said there. I've not played Mortal Kombat 1, but every bit of footage that I see, I just think that sounds sick. Everything you taught me last week on the podcast, which, yes, please check out if you haven't, about the cameo system sounded really cool. Probably going to be a little bit divisive, probably going to be a little bit controversial, but it's a new way to play. It's going to differentiate it from MK11. And even though it's not necessarily my thing on paper, I do like that it's there.
Yeah, well, initially I didn't. And then I was just like, after playing through it and getting used to some of the mechanics and when you summon your cameo in and doing combos with them, it does have that light bulb moment of like, oh my God, this extends everything. It's just a really cool system that you can start putting stuff together with. And I hate how much I like the idea of doing cosmetics on two characters at once. Mm-hmm. I just hate that I want to do that. I need Sub-Zero and Frost to look cool together. I need Scorpion and Sub-Zero, whoever, or Liu Kang and Kung Lao to look awesome together. So I'm going to get lost in that stuff. I don't want to throw too much actual money at them in addition, but if they're doing cool skin packs, it's going to be hard to say no.
Yeah.
I hate it. I hate every bit of that. The next one down is Payday 3 out on the 21st of September. Now, Payday is not my franchise at all, but it might be yours.
Well, it's not even mine. This is another one that I've thrown in because I'm just intrigued by it, so I won't go into too much detail. It's another one where I keep seeing the trailers and it's obviously been talked about for years. It's been a lot of years since Payday 2. And I'm just intrigued by it coming back at all because to my knowledge, like Payday 2 towards the end of its life didn't have that. It wasn't received all that well. I could be entirely wrong here, but I just remember like the reputation of that game and the developers kind of like, like dive bombing a little bit. So I feel like Payday 3 has a little bit to prove. And from the trailers, I just think it's a little bit fascinating. And it's one of those where I wanted to throw it on because if this drops on like a PlayStation Plus or a Game Pass or something, then I will absolutely give it a try.
This feels like almost like a Dead by Daylight where it's like, it's got its fans. You know that it's there. People talk about Payday quite a lot, but it hasn't broken all the way through to like a Fall Guys or a whatever. It's not a go-to multiplayer experience for the masses, but it is there and it has its fans, like a cult classic multiplayer.
It's always one where my friends that I play PlayStation with, they'll always say, should we get Payday? We never do, but I'm waiting for it to break through to the point where we have to go like, oh my God, that is a must play now, you know?
I always loved, like, as a comparison, I loved the bank heist mode in Kane and Lynch.
Yeah.
But it's like, I only played that, like, once because that game just died. And it was like, well, that was such a cool idea. And the idea of not knowing who you're going to screw over so you get to make out with more money or whatever is such a cool idea.
Yeah, man.
And I get that Payday is that idea made into a whole game, but it never blew up as much as anything else.
After loving Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the game, I'm just really into these kind of dedicated multiplayer experiences now. I was so buzzing that Killing Floor 3 was announced at Gamescom.
Right.
Because Killing Floor 2, I absolutely love jumping on that with friends.
I don't think I know what that game is. I know Killing Floor by Blackstone Cherry. That's a song. It's as much as I can do.
It's a, yeah, like a co-op zombie shooter, like horde mode sort of gimmick.
Let's talk about Cyberpunk 2077 dropping September 26th, my friend.
This is sick, right? This is so sick of CDPR to do this to me personally, because there are so many games coming out this year.
Yeah.
There's so many RPGs coming out this year, and they have the audacity to not only drop what looks like an absolute stunning expansion, but also the retooling of the original game, because it not only makes me want to play this DLC, Scott, it makes me want to go back through the entire thing again and re-experience it. It's I hate that is so high up my list now.
It's like, I love Cyberpunk. I've always loved Cyberpunk. You can go back to all the footage, all the coverage that we did when that game first dropped. I've always loved this game. I get, obviously, the problems with it. There was a whole thing that it crashed every 20 minutes on PlayStation 5. I get it. It wasn't what they said it was going to be. It always needed retooling, but I love CDPR's writing, so I'm always going to be there for that. I love the world itself. I think it's one of the best cities, best depictions of nightlife and city life in gaming history. I love the whole message of Cyberpunk's story as well, about actually you want to disconnect from that, because that's one of the worst things you can get lost in. You'll lose yourself to it. It's great. And so it's one of those things where now that they're doing all this stuff and they're making a point of going, this is like the next massive expansion. We've got Phantom Liberty, which is the next story bit, but we've also overhauled everything else. And it's, thank the Lord that they're doing this for free, because this is pretty much Cyberpunk 2. Like, if you any other company would have just slapped a number on this for the amount that they've overhauled it. And it's also another thing where you can't escape the fact that they did do all that stuff, that they did give us the in-progress version of it.
Yeah.
And there's all the behind-the-scenes reports saying that they needed another couple of years in development anyway to get to the design goals that they were trying to implement in the first place. It was just released too early. Doesn't mean you can't have fun with the version that dropped in 2020 like I did or we did, but it's just that weird double-think thing where it's like, okay, I guess this is the one that we should be excited for, because this is actually the one that's closer to all the original trailers with the police chasers and all the cyber mods and hacking your own face and putting cameras in it or whatever it is. But it's just the weirdest release. Like, I'm going to dive in. I'm going to start another save. I've always had one playthrough left, one life path that I didn't pick. It was Nomad. I want to do that again. But it's just, I can't be like that excited about it,
right?
Because it almost neutralizes itself. It gets in its own way.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very subjective, very person by person regarding how they feel about the game. But for instance, when they dropped the official next gen releases, and I know you went back in and dabbled a little bit,
yes,
and you were asking me, "Are you going to go back in?" And at that point, it was too soon. I was still too frankly pissed off at them, because I thought, well, I should have waited. I should have played this version. And like you, I love the original game in spite of all of its flaws.
Yeah.
Again, go back to those podcasts where we talk about how much we love the writing, how much we loved it in spite of it crashing every 30 minutes. But again, it's kind of a paradox, because I was still pissed off. It still wasn't the game they released. I was still annoyed that the game was crashing as much as it was, and it had all of these bugs and glitches. But now, for me personally, I am far enough away from that to think about giving it a try from the beginning, because it has changed so much. You've had those next-gen upgrades. You've had this total overhaul, and now you've had the DLC, 3 years removed by the time this thing comes out. I'm kind of at peace with it. I'm ready to kind of like accept it and move on. As someone who, is really been rooting for Battlefield 2042 from day one and has a similar relationship with that game, where I really enjoyed it at launch but could recognize that it had all of these missed opportunities, that all of these broken promises, and now that similarly got to a good state. It's like, right, I'm finally there with Cyberpunk, where I'm back on the journey with you. I didn't jump in and jump off. I'm back on, like, for the full
duration.
Yeah,
my thing was, like, I left it installed for ages, because obviously they'd patched it. They would patch it a lot anyway, and then they took a break, and then they put the, like you said, the next-gen version out, which was it was like a PlayStation 5 version of the game, and then you could port your save over, and it ran a lot better, the frame rate was better and whatever, and then I started another new character and I started running around as them, but I was always waiting to do like a proper playthrough on Nomad once they did the overhaul stuff. And so I've always been waiting for this to go again, but at the same time, you can't do a proper playthrough the first time again. We've done the main beats of the story. Me and you know what happens. We've been through the Johnny Silverhand stuff. I'm not going to spoil things here.
Yeah.
Obviously, it involves him. But we've done those things. And unless they've added more pivot points and more ways of going through that main story, at some point, I think I'm just going to drop off, because I've done that main thread. Mainly the life path only affects the first like half an hour, unless they've really changed it.
I totally get that. I think that's going to be another sort of personal thing, because maybe I have, I don't know, maybe I have more of a stomach for replaying games than you. I don't know. But I used to always be a kind of purist in thinking this first viewing of a movie, this first playthrough of a game needs to be perfect because I'm only going to get to do it once. But since then, and since I've like started to re-embrace replaying things, like my second playthrough of The Witcher 3 was better than the first.
Right.
My second playthrough of Death Stranding was better than the first. You know, Red Dead Redemption, Last of Us 2, the list goes on. I've kind of unlocked something in my brain where, you know, sometimes the second time through is better than the first.
Oh, no, I also back that too. Right. Like, I do, whenever I do stick with something to go back through it again, I do, I mean, Final Fantasy 7, I've been through that so many times and I absolutely love it. It's just that, like, because that first playthrough was so good,
right?
Like, I did love my time with Cyberpunk so much, that it's just it's gonna be weird looking at how much they've bolted on. What have they kept? What have they lost? Have they rewritten any bits of it? What characters have they added? How impactful is Idris Elba's character now that he's like the main extension of the main story or whatever it is for that DLC? Because you can't access that from the start. Apparently, that's like some point in the story where it deviates off and you go and do something else. It's just kind of fascinating the way that it's all rolled out. My personal ultimate bottom line is that I love Cyberpunk Fiction and CDPR, so I am all in on this, like, in every possible way, and I just want to get lost in it again. I just worry that you almost can't, because the drive to see what's next is, to some degree, going to be neutralized, because I know what's next. I know what the actual story is.
Right.
And I know there are branching paths, there are different endings, but the bulk of that game in the middle is the same. Yeah. As far as I know, it's only the opening and the very end that like fractures out. So I'm just curious. They've added so many play styles that I think actually just interacting with it will feel so much better. And deflecting bullets with your sword is like awesome and things like that. So I'm just a weird rollout of a game where 3 years later, we've got this other sort of like quasi-sequel version of it. And it's weird the way that they're advertising it on the trailers, because they're just listing all the stuff that was missing.
Yeah.
We've added car chases. We've added all these things that recognize all these different paths that you asked for. And I'm like, is this what the game was always going to be? Or is this you reacting to what it was? Have you No Man's Skied it, or is this what you were always going to do?
You know what? And like, again, you know, if you don't think you should give the developers props for this, fair enough.
Yep.
If you'd spent like the collector's edition price in this game back at launch and, you know, got burnt 100%, totally respect that. But, you know, like games like No Man's Sky are champion today because the developers were given that opportunity to put in the work and make it something special. And I think I'm just glad to sort of see them do that with Cyberpunk, because they could have just cut and run and done Cyberpunk 2, right? They could have just done Anthem 2.0 and said, this isn't worth our time. The brand is tarnished, but they've done a No Man's Sky, or seemingly done a No Man's Sky. I mean, the Phantom Liberty might come out, it might be crap, but I hope it's not. I hope it's not.
Well, I quite like the way they've split it, where they've sort of got Phantom Liberty is a premium DLC. It has a price tag. I forget how much it is, but it has a price tag. But the base game of Cyberpunk is being overhauled regardless. Like, if you have an internet connection and you try and play it, it will ask you to install all the new stuff. So you get all the gameplay. You get the new game. Like, it's just that you don't get the story stuff. You don't get the DLC. But you get everything else. It's just a weird thing in gaming history, because they're wiping out the original version. Like, it is being completely overhauled. And they tried to overhaul the progression last time as well. They tried to change the skills that you unlock and how you get them and whatever else. And now it's been simplified and overhauled even more.
Yeah.
And the UI looks completely different and everything else. And it's just like, this is just weird. It's weird to delete your own history.
Yeah.
And go like, well, this is what we actually meant, guys.
Well, you know what, man? Like, AAA games on the level of CDPR would never do this. But it's hilarious looking at the release of Cyberpunk compared to Baldur's Gate 3. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Baldur's Gate 3, in early access for a long time, had that kind of developmental period where it was building word of mouth, it was making fixes, it was improving, and then it dropped as the complete article, got all of these accolades, got all of this widespread attention that it might not have otherwise get. I always wonder what the response to Cyberpunk would have been had that original version dropped in early access. Had we experienced the game back then and gone on podcasts and gone, look, the storyline's amazing, the writing's incredible, this is a world you want to live in, but it has all of these problems. When this comes out, it's going to be incredible. And then we would have been here in 2023 with it wrapping up that early access period, having fixed all this with a premium DLC rolled in and being like, this is the game. I just think that early access model is something that like AAA developers need to look into a little bit more, especially when they're pushing out games as big as this and live service games that come, always arrive lacking in content, you know?
That's a really good point in terms of, because I think it's a double-edged sword. I think so many devs, or publishers, it's nearly always the publishers, have decided to embrace the early access model. model, but not call it that. Yeah. Just give you the most, what's the most alpha version of the game we can ship out there, kick out the door and charge you for. And it's always that thing where the game's not finished yet, oh, but the storefront is. And it's just that whole thing, like, we can just monetize you as soon as possible. I do agree, though, that the amount of, that you could use the early access model to attempt various multiplayer ideas and concepts and stuff. And if something takes, then you focus development on that. And maybe that would be a way to sort of game jam various ideas together, release them in the wild, see what takes, and then put the money into the one that takes off.
Absolutely. I just think it's a more, ethical is a strong word, but ethical way of doing things, because you can, like, you refer to it as early access. Mm. We as fans and consumers then expect a certain level of product out of that. We don't expect the finished game. You sell it at a lower price point. It allows those fans to jump in. It allows those fans to shape it, to get a taste of what's to come, without just treating them like mugs and just releasing full price games, like you said, with the fixed storefront for full price, and then just being like, well, we don't care if you were excited. We don't care if you spent £200 on the collector's edition. We'll fix this in 2 years, 3 years when we have a roadmap.
I would love like a full dev breakdown of why that isn't possible, because I'm already thinking of things like, if Anthem was in early access, it just wouldn't have the player base. Like, there's no reason to try it without the panache of an EA-backed, BioWare-developed new game.
Yeah,
like,
what do you reckon?
I think people would have dipped their toes and gone, eh.
Well,
it would have died 2 years before it actually died.
The thing is, man, I think they have...
Still would have saved them money, though.
...way more of a chance, because if you look at indie games that have blown up out of nowhere, you know, what's that, The Forest, you know, The Forest 2, which I think is in early access right now on PC, and it was, like, streamed all over the globe, you know, like, huge amount of interest, a lot of people jumping in, you know, all of the old, was PUBG in early access, or was it a mod for a little bit?
Ooh, PUBG was like a weird, was a mod, I think, for H1Z1, and then it blew up and became its own thing.
Well, it similarly had this long tail where it, like, got people interested.
I'm word of mouth is powerful,
And I'm sure there are a bunch of, you know, stories of games launching in early access that then weren't good and then it did damage them overall, but I think, I don't know, imagine the amount of people who would say, BioWare's next title, early access, I'm going to jump in now, and I'm going to accept that there's not many... It's going to be improved. I mean, that is exactly kind of what happened with Baldur's Gate, and it just absolutely slapped.
It's true. It's just a weird thing, because I think Baldur's is a weird anomaly because of how it was financed. And I always forget the name of the dude, but the guy that owns Larian, he has a lot of money and put his own personal money into it to get it over the line. Because the original like release version of Baldur's got like a 7 out of 10 from IGN, and it was like, oh, it's fine, but it's nothing special and whatever. And then over a long enough time period with enough money, eventually it becomes the version that is out now. And I just have to look at that as such an anomaly. I don't think EA would stick with it the way that Larian's personal funds did. To get that game over the finish line. EA would be like, this isn't working, we're going to get rid of it.
Oh, don't get me wrong, I fully agree. That is why they don't do it, right? Yeah. I mean, those big publishers prioritize day one sales over anything else. So if they even get a whiff of the idea that early access might take even a percent of those sales away, that is absolutely why they're not doing it. I just mean in like a utopian world where they did adopt those approaches and they were understanding of the market and like were able to go, we're putting out an early access, but we actually are supporting it, you know?
Actually, mentioning EA, it is ironic because they are doing that with Skate.
Yeah.
Like, that is entirely the model they're doing with Skate. And they're trying to build the community around the early access version of Skate and getting all the community feedback and what do you guys think? And then they showed at Christmas last year, they showed the like wireframe version of the game. And they're like, oh, this is what we've done so far. I personally don't like that. I like the model, but I personally don't care because it's not finished. So I'm just like, I want to see the thing that's finished.
Here's the thing. I'm the same. Mm. Like, I never jump in early access. I will always be the guy who waits for the official release. But I just think
it's interesting as a way to like make the finances work.
That's it. I just think overall, as a benefit to the industry, it is a benefit because, you know, otherwise I am getting the early access versions of these games. Like, I just am. Like, I got the early access version of Cyberpunk. I got the early access version, more or less, of Jedi Survivor. You know what I mean? I'm doing it anyway, so why not just tell me up front and then I'll wait and then I'll get a better version myself. And then you just kind of, I don't know, I just think you avoid all this controversy.
No, that's true. I think it's one of those things where, like, which version of the game are you calling early access? Because if you call Jedi Survivor early access, I then wouldn't have a problem with the performance mode being all over the place.
Yeah.
Because it would be more understandable or acceptable, but I wouldn't have paid the money. They wouldn't have got my money.
Right.
I'd be waiting until, you know, months down the line. I mean, right now I think it's finally fixed, but it's like I'd be waiting for that long before I jumped in. And maybe that skews the optics of your marketing so much that they just couldn't go anywhere near it. If let's say right now every game released in early access, then every bug is therefore understandable,
yeah,
which makes the general word of mouth more positive.
Yes.
But it also makes everybody way more cautious, and everybody then waits and just waits and waits and waits until it's the best version. And by then, I think it's fallen off everybody's radar anyway.
I think the opposite, just because I think if you release something now, like Jedi Survivor, you have the hype and you have the expectations of a full price release, and then suddenly everyone's holding off until it's fixed. And then it's like, when's it going to be fixed? Or it's finally fixed now. Oh no, wait for two more patches. And you don't have that official re-release almost that I think kind of like Cyberpunk is getting now in No Man's Sky got with the expansions, where you get that second swell. Mm-hmm. For me, early access remedies that, because you get the early access launch, which obviously is a big deal. It comes with all those caveats that you mentioned and the kind of lowering the bar of expectations. Mm. But then you almost get like a second release when the game actually drops. And then for me, in my brain, that then spikes interest again. Whereas you don't get that second spike, I don't think, to that extent when you just sort of fix something and say, oh, it's done now.
No, that's very true. And as that direct comparison, it would work to do the actual release thing. It's just a weird massaging of the marketing rollout, because it's almost like an extension of, for example, EA again. If they did, because they obviously right now have EA Originals, Immortals of Avium is the most recent one, It Takes Two, whatever. They have that label. They could do an EA Originals Game Jam thing. I keep using Game Jam as an example because it's various like smaller projects that get off the ground all at once. They could do an EA Originals access program where you have access to various games early on in development, and they, marketing wise, don't make a big deal about it.
Yeah.
And then, but they then do when one of them is greenlit, and all of a sudden it's shared across all the various EA games and EA access and everything else to say this game is actually fully available now. There's maybe a way to make that work. I think my gut says it would put too many people off and like paying it, still wondering if it's ready yet or whatever. And then buying it day one when they tell you that it's ready, and then it still needs to be patched, and being like, oh, I just bought the early access version anyway.
Well, this is it. This is basically the assumption that when the game does launch, it is complete. Yeah. It is like Cyberpunk now, or it is Baldur's Gate 3 now. Like I say, this is a utopian version of it. This is assuming that like all of those issues are ironed out, and then it's like the rock solid version that you would have expected if it was just a full price.
I mean, the crux is that consumers don't know what they're buying. We're always trying to find solutions to the fact that the industry loves selling you the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Like, or selling you something that isn't optimum to what you thought it was going to be. Final game in September is EA Sports FC 24, 29th of September. You chuck this in, it's a big deal. He's loving the footballs.
I really am. You know, I'm getting back into football. No! You know, I'm having a nightmare with it, but I'm getting back into it. Over the past few years, I've been getting back into club football, to my detriment. What's that mean? Well, loads of bad things are happening. Apparently, it turns out just nightmares are going on all the time in club football. That's not the point.
Okay.
The point is, obviously, that has coincided with them, losing the FIFA license and this being their first non-FIFA branded title, maybe ever. I don't know if they even did football games before they got that license, but
I don't think they did.
It's another one of those games, like Cyberpunk and like Starfield, where I think they need to prove themselves.
Yeah.
Like, they probably don't. They can probably just coast on people realizing that it's FIFA and just buying it as they do every year. But I think for the first year out, at least, surely they've got to prove why people still need to care and why this is the game that they need to buy and not the official FIFA competitor that will probably come out like 10 years.
That was the weird, there's two things to this. Like, one was the head of FIFA saying that they would make their own game back when this license thing split happened, where EA like didn't renew the license, and then the guy from FIFA was like, we don't even need them, we'll do our own FIFA game. That hasn't materialized at all, which would have been hilarious to see, because apparently the head of FIFA is like this insane guy. So that would have been a thing to see. The other one is that I do think on the trailers that are available for this, it does look like a massive step up.
Yeah, you said this, which I thought was really interesting.
And it's like, because I'm not like a huge football guy. I watch the World Cup. I've played FIFA over the years growing up with it. My friends always had it. I'd always have a casual game every now and then. And I know how to play FIFA and whatever. But like, this thing, as soon as they started rolling it out, I was like, okay, I want to know what this looks like. What does a FIFA game look like where they've lost the license? Like you said, how much do they need to prove themselves? And I think the footage for FC 24 looks pretty awesome. Like, it does look like a next-gen step up. And I don't know if I assume there's a version for previous consoles as well. There nearly always is. But it just looks like a big step up. It still looks like shiny people versus realistic skin textures.
Yeah.
But I just think that overall, it just looks like it runs very, very well. And they need it to land.
Yes.
Like, this is so, like, very rarely, if ever in gaming, has there been a brand pivot like this.
No,
you know, like an IP runs, like a license runs out, and you need the entire audience to go, look at this one. I don't think that's ever happened before.
It's because you've always had it, right? Like, obviously, The WWE brand changed publishers.
That might be the last time that happened.
But even then, they retained the WWE license. Yeah. Like, it obviously changed, but it was still branded as WWE.
I think
FIFA has become so synonymous with, like, football and this series that I do think it is a big thing to not have that.
Totally.
Especially as a really, really casual player like me who then starts thinking, you know, well, what licenses are they going to lose? Are they going to lose anything? Like, will things not be as authentic as they were previously, because that's why I go to FIFA.
Yeah.
That's why I always played FIFA and not PES. Like, PES, by all accounts, to anyone who played that franchise, it played better, it was more satisfying, it was more...
I remember being a Pro Evo kid.
Yeah, it was more
ISS
rewarding.
As well.
But because I was playing as, you know, London Blues and not Chelsea or whoever, I just could never get into it because I bought for that level of sort of simulation.
Did you not... This is such a specific memory, a specific time in our lives, but did you not get the newest Pro Evo and then go home and go in the customization and make it all authentic?
I'll probably talk about this in a chat at some point. I'm surprised I'm not before, but I have a core memory of getting PES for the first time, assuming they had the licenses because they got the licenses for a couple teams on the front. I think it was like Barcelona and Man United or something. So I didn't even think that a football game wouldn't have the football teams. And I remember the disappointment of getting home and thinking,
what?
Oh no.
I remember having to get, because it was like, I think it was the Netherlands were like Oranges 11 or something.
Yeah.
And I remember that being held up at the time in my school as like, oh my God, look what they haven't got. But the fact that they let you go and customize it, like I was a WWE fan, wrestling fan at the time, so I'm used to customizing everything. So I'd go in and fight for Newcastle United, find the stripes and put them back on.
So pleased you've mentioned wrestling, because that killed wrestling games for me.
What?
You know, when you would like get, you shut your mouth or here comes the pain or whatever. If I was watching wrestling at the time and I was really into a wrestler who wasn't in the game, that game that I was playing was immediately dead to me. I needed the next game with them, and officially, I could make them, but I always knew they were
all
like,
the moves would be in there.
It's not a point. I knew in my brain they were bootleg versions. I knew they weren't like authentic. I knew they hadn't been developed. And it was the same with PES. It's like, I could go in and rename everything and tweak it, but I knew I'd be bootlegging it. And there was just
it doesn't matter.
Something about it.
You'll
that
make
I
it
just,
your own.
I didn't like that whatsoever. I needed it to be official. And I still kind of do. I'm not as obsessed about it as I was back then. But even now,
you
man,
cook food versus buying food.
Wait, oh, come on, that is not the same. Do not do this to me. You can. It's like getting like a bootleg sort of DVD or something, or a bootleg figure.
It's the same movie.
I just know in my head. I know that those aren't McDonald's fries, Mum.
We got ice cream at home, or ice cubes at home. Yeah. The way that they're rolling this thing out, they haven't really steered into, you know, from the makers of FIFA. I have to assume that contractually they just can't say that. I don't know if that's in the trailer, but I don't feel like I'm seeing that much advertised. I don't feel like I'm seeing them steer into it as much as they could, as opposed to just having the FC24 logo be on the homepage of the Xbox or the PlayStation Store. I think there's a version of this on Switch. I could be wrong. But still, I'm fascinated more from a marketing, like a gaming industry standpoint, where I'm just like, can you make the audience go across?
Absolutely.
That's interesting. And then do you change anything? Do you play it safe because it's your big pivot, or do you do something that FIFA wouldn't let you do before?
I'm just so excited to keep my eye on games industry biz and their sales updates to see if it dips at all. Like, I'd be fascinated to see if the brand is so big that it doesn't need the brand, that it will just penetrate into the mainstream and people will recognize it as FIFA and they won't have to spend money on marketing to transition people over. I genuinely don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah, and when it comes to like team licenses and stuff as well, all those things seem to be separated out. So you can lose the FIFA name as the umbrella term, but you can still license all the teams separately anyway.
Yeah.
So in theory, this is the next FIFA. It's just the only thing that's changing is the name of the game.
I want to say the only thing they lose is the World Cup. Maybe Champions League is a different body, but I think they lose the World Cup, and I think they mentioned that at the start. They were like, right, everything's going to be the same. The only thing you don't get is this. You know,
I'll tell you another thing as well, which is really interesting, is that they long have said or talked about how much money the FIFA license costs to maintain, and it's like this astronomical, stupid figure, because obviously it's one of the big. It is the biggest sport in the world.
It was like $1 billion or something, wasn't it?
Something nuts, and there was always a potential out, which I didn't give them. There was always a potential out that the only reason they have Ultimate Team and it's so money hungry, the only reason they have an Ultimate Team that is so money hungry is to make enough money to make sure they can get the license for the next year, the next year, the next year. Is EA Sports FC 24 going to be a more consumer-friendly game?
Nah.
I don't think so either.
I think I remember doing that news with you and saying at the time, like, if they are looking at expenses and they have $1 billion expenses and they can take that away while continuing to add 2 billion, they are not going to go, nah, you know what, we'll be all right this time. We'll take Ultimate Team out, which is, you know, Ultimate Team, it's something I've never dabbled in.
Mm-hmm.
So that is, I mean, they need to address it at some point, surely, but I guess not right now.
Yeah, I want to just, like, that's the thing. If you can just take away your expenses to FIFA and just keep everything else.
Exactly, right?
I mean,
imagine you're, like, Mr. EA, and you're going to the shareholder mission meetings.
It's a mission for him, yeah.
Yeah, it is, aye. And you're looking at your graph, and you're just looking at how far that graph can go up.
We could be nicer, or we could spike the living F out of it, and it could go all the way up here.
And you've got someone arguing, but what, shouldn't we be nice to the people who, like, love this game? Should we not be predatory in our aggressive monetization? And the guy's just like, the graph goes up though. The graph goes up.
But the graph goes up, mate.
Now.
Yeah, it's a weird thing because I think EA right now are on a slight, I don't want to give them too much credit because they'll take advantage of it and then they'll ruin themselves again, but they're on a bit of an uptick. The EA Originals label's doing really, really well. I've loved all of the EA Originals so far. I haven't played Immortals yet, but It Takes Two, A Way Out, and Unravel have all been great. And that's a nice little portion of their business that's doing pretty well. And you know, they've got the licenses for like Black Panther and everything. It seems like they've learned from the last few years.
They've seen
what happened across the last few years. And some of the moves they are doing are in a better light. But whether that holds is another thing.
I similarly agree on the podcast that we did that went up on Tuesday. I was also saying, you know, I think they have learned from the likes of Star Wars and single player
Star
games
Wars is another
being
one, yeah.
back, you know, which gives me a little bit of hope for BioWare and Dragon Age and Mass Effect. But As we've seen with EA before, we've seen them like start being quote unquote good again, just to tank it when the money needs to go up. So
it's always the thing. Every few years, I always refer to this as the baton of hate. The baton of hate gets passed between different companies. Ubisoft had it for the early 2010s. They gave it to Konami for the end of the 2010s. Then it went to Warner Brothers for a while, and they've still had it. They're about to pass it on, I feel, but I don't know who to.
Right.
And I wonder whether they end up giving it to EA, because it's like EA hasn't been in the spotlight. Hasn't been in the crosshairs for a while. And there's always, if there's any heat somewhere else, everyone else takes advantage of that. And then we all notice and go, no, they suck now.
Then
the spotlight shifts over for a bit. So it's been a little while. We're overdue a baton hate pass.
I just hope the Marvel license doesn't do it to them like the Star Wars license did, where they just went like nuts with them power
it's
and possibilities.
Much. Yeah, all their eyes glowing as they cackle in the distance. They're fully powering up. So that's been September. To run those down, 6th of September is Baldur's Gate and Starfield, same day. 7th of September, Final Fantasy VII, Ever Crisis. 12th is Mythforce. 14th is The Crew Motorforce. 19th is Lies of P and Mortal Kombat 1. 21st of September is Payday 3. 26th is Cyberpunk 2077, Phantom Liberty. And the 29th is EA Sports FC 24. Football Club.
Decent list, that, isn't
it's
it?
It's not too bad, is
the
it?
The annoying thing is we're going to have to be catching up on August games by the time these start rolling around.
I'm going
to
just sit in bed with my Switch and play Sea of Stars, and when that's done, I'll breathe and play everything else. But until then, I'm not going to get through anything else. But we'll just see. There's plenty of games this month and plenty more coming next month. But for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you throughout the week.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.